suddenly we hear rumbling and we look, avalanches are coming towards us. So we were in the Western Kumbe between Everest, Lhotse and Numtse. These are mountains. It was actually an earthquake of 8.4 magnitude that shook the mountains, and rocks, snow, everything was coming at us. Now, Nawang didn't show the leadership that he showed before, where he said, "Sarah, we are jumping." He didn't give me instructions. He just started praying. Leadership isn't tested when things go according to plan. It's tested in the moment you have to decide whether to keep going.
My name is Sarah Kumalo, a businesswoman, a mother, and an award-winning mountaineer. I know what it feels like when the ground shakes beneath you. Three times, Mount Everest sent me back down through avalanche, earthquake, and injury. Three times, the world told me to quit. I kept going, and on the fourth attempt, I stood on the summit. Most would call the earlier attempts failure, but I learned something different. The shift is not the disruption. The shift is the lesson. It's not the fall that defines you, but the rise. Because true failure only happens when you stop taking the next step. In when shift happens, we explore the moments that break us and how they build us. Take a breath. The air is thin up here, and the views are worth it. Welcome to the summit journey. Let's go higher.
Well, Sarah is, she's a friend, she's a mom, she's a businesswoman, she's a sister. She's an adventurer, very playful at heart. But more importantly, she's a leader of self and others at best of times. What drew me to Everest wasn't a childhood dream of Everest, because I didn't even know about Everest. It was really a moment when my sister died, my older sister. I'm one of seven girls. And that was a shock about the sudden news, the sudden loss, and the confusion thereof, because you don't expect it. And I remember just wondering whether she had achieved her purpose. And I got confused. I had a good job. And until then, I thought I was successful. I mean, I had a car, a house. I was boss lady at work. I was earning enough, you know, for me and my family. And the world I came from, including my family, saw me as successful. And I remember just reflecting and realizing that I wasn't, actually. Because I went back to my childhood, where my mother always used to say, the sky is the limit. And I questioned myself, am I reaching for the skies? And the answer was no. And I went back to my grandfather, who always used to say, if you don't live a life of service, it's a life wasted. He was a pastor. And so him saying that and preaching all the time is something as kids we just ignored. But for some reason that evening, 2009, that question came back and I said, no, I quit my job and left. Now that I've been exposed to Simon Sinek's work, starting with your why or finding your why, I've realized that was what was going on, even though at the time I just felt maybe it was midlife crisis. I quit a well-paying job. I had shares in First Rand and went to work at the post office. And why did I do that? Just because a bunch of us were going to turn Post Bank into the bank for the people. And it felt like that was purposeful. That was service. That was me making a difference to a group of people that were not part of the economy in the previous regime. And so I left. Since then, every job that I took was about, is it aligned to my values? Am I going to add value? Which is something that before then never crossed my mind. It was about, is it going to get me to the C-suite? Is it going to give me enough money to live a lifestyle that the world expects of me? And that completely shifted my perspective. And somehow along the way, I found myself in a business that encouraged employees to do something different for the community. And we were looking after a home in Benoni that looks after street kids. Every month, at the end of the month, we'll ask our colleagues to give us donations, and we'll take these kids out, and every month thereafter, you go to people's offices just after payday. They see you coming. They pretend to be busy on their laptops, on their computers, because there's donor fatigue that you and I know today. Everybody's got their own problems. Everybody wants to give you less. Everyone wants to probably ignore you because their problems seem bigger, you know, than what they could handle at that time. And at the time, a friend said they were climbing Kili, and it used to be on my bucket list at the time. It was actually on my bucket list, funny enough, for over a decade. And I said, yeah, I want to climb Kili. We were preparing, and as we were preparing, I came up with an idea that maybe we can use Kili to raise money for Kids Heaven. That way, we're not begging for donations. We're sharing our experience. We're going to sell our experience to the people and raise enough money. So to cut the story short, Kili wasn't easy. I almost didn't summit, but I did. And we raised enough money, built an outdoor gym worth about 200,000 rands, converted the room into a library for the children. And when we were handing over, one of the kids in the home came to me and said, "Do you really come from the township?" I remember initially laughing because I thought, you know, she was joking. Do black people swim is a joke that we always make, you know. And she looked at me with a serious face and said, "No, people like us don't do things like this." And I remember looking at her and thinking, damn, so who does? And she says it's exchange students that come from Europe. When they come to Kids Heaven, when they leave, their parents do these things. It just dawned on me that she had a sense of self-disbelief. Honestly, that I too grew up with, watching Wonder Woman, Superman, She-Ra. You know, if you know those, you probably can guess my age. You know, and I too felt like superheroes are those that I watch and applaud. It can never be me. A sense of self-disbelief. Now, as a mother of two boys, my kids were very young at the time. I remember looking at them and thinking, what can I do so that they don't have to feel like that, so that they know that help comes from within before they looked elsewhere? And so about 3 weeks thereafter, friends of mine and I were hiking, and I said, you know what, I actually want to do more of this. I want to climb the seven highest peaks on the seven continents and use it to raise money for education. Because the honest truth is, the difference between that child and I was that I was educated. And then I traveled. Travel opened my eyes to the fact that I too can be a superhero in education. So I decided I'll climb the seven highest peaks, not knowing which ones they were exactly, honestly, but use it to raise money for education. Because it's the equalizer. I mean, if you now reflect on what the UN is saying, Africa has the youngest population. And for us to change the narrative for those, that generation, the next generation, education should be the foundation. And that's why I started climbing. Summits with a Purpose and Everest happened to be one of those seven. You might be thinking that Everest was a random thought, but the reality is, I know for a fact that I'm an accidental mountaineer, and that's why it's exciting for me. It's not something that I planned. It's something that I was called into, and I absolutely loved it. So chatting to my friends, we are on a hike, and I come up with this. We need to do the seven summits. Actually, the friend I was with is Erica Gibson and Karine Duplessis. They say to me, oh, and Erica had just come from Aconcagua. He says, I know somebody. I know Sibusiso Vilani. Maybe we should call him and ask him about this because he's done the seven summits. We're like, okay. She made a call and he said that we can come and see him in Nelspruit. You know, like everything else that I do in my life is, you know, investigate, look at the risks, figure it out. What do I need? What does it require from me? You know, how can I prepare and plan? And we got there. He looked at us. One of the things that was a revelation at the time was that every mountain is different, and you climb it differently, you train for it differently, something that I didn't know until then. And as we moved along, he said, no, they were actually going to climb the mountain in 2014. And I said to myself, A, I don't have enough money. Until then, I didn't know actually people asked for money to be sponsored to go and climb. For me, it was about, like I did with Kelly, saved up money, and when I had enough, I had to go. And for me, Everest was the most expensive, and I was going to do it last when, you know, I have enough money. And I come back to the office. We met him over the weekend. I come back to the office. A young man comes to my office, sets up an appointment with my PM, Luazingwenya. He also worked at the company I worked for. And he comes into my office and says, "Hi, this is who I am." Like he was larger than life. And he says to me, "You must come with us to Everest 2014. I'm like, "No, I'm not ready. I don't have enough money." Then he says, "No, but, you know, we can ask people to, you know, to fund us." And I said to him, "But why would anybody want to fund us?" He says, "But because you're going to be the first Black African woman to summit Everest." And I said to him, "No." The Sean, at the time, I thought she had summited. And he said to me, "No." He grabs my laptop. He Googles and says, "See? So she climbed, but she never summited." So I said, "Oh." He says, "And I'll use that to actually ask for funding." Like I said, he was larger than life. He dragged me along. We went to Barry Swartzberg's office, who's one of the founders of Discovery. And he said, "We're going to climb Everest, and we want you to fund us." I remember him looking at us and says, "What makes you think you can summit?" And, you know, we chatted a little bit, and we promised him to say we're going to bring him a stone from the mountain once we summit. And he offered to give us a quarter of what we needed each. And after that, we started training. We went to Boven. I had never rock climbed. I started rock climbing. We went to France to try. It's the first time I put on crampons, you know, and knew what they were. First time I realized there actually could be an avalanche and you need to arrest yourself when there's an avalanche. I bought my gear. I remember I had the worst shoes you need for that type of terrain. And I kept slipping and slipping. And we were there for a week. And on the last day, Loisy decided he's not doing this anymore. He's staying in the hotel. And I said, "No, I have to." And I went with the guide. And he was, I promise you, he was very different to what Kilimanjaro guides are. Kilimanjaro guides babysit you. They hold your hand. They jump before you cough. This guy was almost half a kilometer away from me and looking at me like, "Come on, viens, viens." I'm falling, I'm getting up, but I keep going. He made me feel like this was the worst decision I had ever made in my life. And when we got back to the hotel that evening, and Loisy says, "Oh, so how did she do?" He looks at him, he says, "She's very strong. She had the worst shoes ever, but she kept getting up and going." And then I realized, damn, my shoes were not the right shoes, which he didn't, you know, bother to tell me. It just made me feel like, you know, I was terrible at this and made terrible decisions in coming there. And so that was introduction to mountaineering for me in that space. And this was 2013. And in 2014, I managed to get myself onto Everest. One of the things that I had made a decision on was that I'll climb the seven highest peaks, but I'll use it to raise money for education. So I started the Summits with a Purpose journey. And I got to Everest, and I went that year with Sibusiso. Unfortunately, Loisy didn't make it at the time. His family dynamics demanded that he should not go. Well, obviously, somebody had Googled Everest and saw the dangers and told him he can't come. And Sibusiso and I were there. And then, before we left at OR Tambo, there was this big send-off because Sibusiso is the first Black man to summit Everest. He had done the seven summits. He was well-known in the media. And I remember just sitting there and my kids were crying because people want to interview you and they can't really say goodbye. I was very much new to this. And we were sent off as heroes. But when I got to Kathmandu, I found a world of mainly white males that are very rich that thought I didn't belong. You know, "What mountains have you climbed? What's the highest mountain in South Africa?" And I'm like, "I've done Kili." And they look at me with that look, except one that outrightly said it, say, "Shouldn't you just be going to Everest Base Camp?" And I realized there's a world out there that looks at me as a female that, you know, my ambition cannot be on par to theirs. That was interesting to realize, and to stubbornness in me said, "I'll show you that I belong." I moved differently from, so when you land, you climb Everest either from the south side or the north side. So you come from Oahu, you land in Kathmandu, and you then fly from Kathmandu to Lukla, the most dangerous airport in the world. 420 meters long, the runway. Actually, just landing at Lukla, you realize that the adventure has begun, because some people never landed. They died before landing because it's that dangerous, the weather, the weight of the plane, and many other factors that come along with it. I landed in Lukla because I knew that they didn't think I belonged, and I needed them to trust me as part of the team. I decided to change my game plan. I started climbing faster so that I get to base camp in the first team, if not the first one, which is a no-no, right? Having gone back over and over later on, I realized that was a mistake, because when I got to Everest base camp, I had altitude sickness because I walked faster than I needed to. I didn't drink as much water, and I got terribly sick on the second day after getting to Everest base camp. If the plan was to go to base camp, that plan of climbing faster, being first, would have worked. But I needed to go further than base camp. So that, what I did, was a no-no, although I didn't know it at the time as a novice. Having said that, on the 18th of April 2014, unfortunately, in the morning around 6 o'clock, we're sleeping in our tents. The tent shakes like vigorously, but I had been told by then, if you hear the tent shaking, there's an avalanche in the surrounding, but we're strategically positioned, it would never affect us. But about 500 meters from us, a big block of ice called a sirac had fallen into the Khumbu Icefall. So you get to base camp, and then you climb through the Khumbu Icefall where they put the ladders. They put the ladders, and when they put the ladders, and they know that it goes all the way up to camp one and then camp two, they declare that the mountain is open. That's the only time that climbers are allowed to get into the Khumbu Icefall. Now, the mountain was opened on the 17th of April, and we had what is called a puja ceremony where we pray. And the idea was on the 18th, we are also going to go up to Camp 1 because it's now safe. And that morning, the sirac fell, and the Sherpas were going to set up Camp 1. And our Sherpas for our camp had actually just crossed where the sirac fell 20 minutes before then. It crushed about 16 Sherpas that morning. We didn't know it at the time. So the tent shakes. I wake up and I go, oh, it's an avalanche. I go back to sleep. Walkie-talkies go crazy around the mountain, like in the camp, but you don't understand because they're speaking in Nepali. Until they needed a paramedic, and the only paramedic that was there in our camp, at least close to me, was Melissa, who was an American female climber. And they go, Melissa, but they had to speak to her in English. We need a paramedic. People are injured. That's the first time I realized something more than just an avalanche around base camp had happened. And so we all rush out of the tent. We go and see. It's like white. Lily white. You can't really see properly what's happening, but you can see it's very close to where we are at. So we go into our dining tent, which is the meeting site, and what's happening? What's happening? Oh, they calm us down. Just have some tea. Don't go into the Khumbu Icefall close by because they are helping people stay away. And I go back. I stand in front of my tent and I'm taking pictures. I'm taking videos. Alas, I see helicopters hovering where this happened, putting lifeless bodies on a rope hanging onto the helicopter and flying the people onto Everest Base Camp. I took a few videos of that, and then I went back into the camp to these people that were more experienced than I was, that made me feel like I didn't belong. And I said, this doesn't look like people are alive. It looks like lifeless bodies. And I showed them, and they say, oh, one person has died, two people. It ended up 16 Sherpas had died that morning. So I said, what do we do? I realized that the people that made me feel like I didn't belong, that made me feel like my experience was, invalid, right? They were just as scared as I was in that moment. One of them actually picked up his bag and said to the shepherd, "Send my duffel bag down, I'm going." And he ran down. And he actually was the one that told me that shouldn't I just be going to Everest Base Camp? A friend sent me a message, because we could still receive WhatsApp messages if we had data. And he said, "Sarah, figure out why you have been saved, and that will inform how best you need to move forward." Then at that time, it was survivor's guilt. You know, did they die because I wanted to climb? Did they die because they loved climbing? Why them and not me? I mean, one of them had summited Everest 13 times. He was a cousin to our expedition leader. And I was confused. I was like not myself at that moment, questioning that decision, because until then I knew and believed that I was meant to do this. And so we were told to leave. The shepherds started rioting because their work conditions were now brought into question. The mountain was closed and all the climbers were sent home. I came home to my kids having seen that, Googled it, and realized it's not Kilimanjaro, it's not the Drakensberg, this is serious, Mom. To people that believed that I could, saying, "You've tried, you don't need to, this is not our thing, you have nothing to prove." But I was more convinced that I must have been saved for a reason, because I couldn't understand why people more experienced that were deserving, maybe in my mind, for being there, died and I was saved. And that kind of reinforced my belief that I was meant to do this. And more importantly, linking it to my purpose, why I was there. And also, it made me realize that representation was important. There was a world out there that didn't know who I am as a Black African woman and decided to put me in a box that their ambition is more valid, you know, is justified than mine is. So I was going to do it for the other Black girl that's going to come behind me. In fact, African girl, white or Black, to be honest, that will come behind me, they must give them the same benefit of the doubt that they give their male counterparts. And so that's why I decided I'll go back in 2015. When I went back in 2015, I had actually, before going back, if I step back, 2014 didn't happen. And I came back and I went and climbed in Europe, because it was about the 7 summits. I did Mount Elbrus in Europe and ticking the 2nd of my 7 summits journey. What is significant, about this is that we always have these goals. Sometimes we're so fixated on the big one that when we fall, we keep going for the big one. We kind of need quick wins that we celebrate as we move forward. And that's what Elbrus in 2014 actually represented for me. And then I went back in 2015 to Everest. 2015, a lot more cleverer, a lot more knowledgeable. I changed a few things. I trained differently. You know, I became a runner, I became a cyclist, I was a lot fitter, not just in the gym, which I did before my first attempt. And I got there, I decided who was going to be my shepherd. Somebody that I knew had 22 years experience, was a lot more mature, wasn't going to take careless decisions, because this was important for my kids and something that I promised them. I was going to take life-preserving steps. And in 2015, I beg your pardon, I was between Camp 1 and Camp 2. When we were walking, my shepherd and I, climbing towards Camp 2, and the idea was this rotation, we touch Camp 2, come back and sleep at Camp 1. This is how you climb Everest. And the ground beneath us, the glacier started shaking. We didn't know what it was. So Nawang turns around, hooks his carabiner. Carabiner is like a hook that you can hook onto an anchor or to your partner so that you are in sync even if there's no visibility. And he says to me, "Sarah, we are jumping." So the idea, if you can imagine, is if the glacier that we are walking on opens up beneath us, we needed to jump to the same side, because if we jumped on opposite sides, one of us would pull the other one in and that was going to be it. Sounds crazy, but at the time I just felt like 22 years experience, I'm a novice, I'm watching his feet, he jumps, I jump. And nothing opened. The ground stopped shaking. suddenly. And when we looked around, he takes the carabiner off. He says, are you all right? I'm all right. He says, okay. So we're looking around. Suddenly, we hear rumblings. And we look, avalanches are coming towards us. So we were in the Western Kum between Everest, Lhotse, and Numtse. These are mountains. It was actually an earthquake of 8.4 magnitude that shook the mountains, and rocks, snow, everything was coming at us. Now, Nawang didn't show the leadership that he showed before, where he said, Sarah, we are jumping. He didn't give me instructions. He just started praying. So this is a Tibetan chant that he and his friends were chanting during puja ceremony. So I memorized it. I knew it was their prayer. I remember looking at him and thinking, this dude is praying to a Tibetan god that doesn't know me. I'm a Christian. I'm like, Jesus, what's the plan? The biggest lesson in this for me is how we show up as leaders when the ground is shaking around us. Because when he said we are jumping, knowing what I know today, we were not going to make it. But I was going to jump with him. And if we were going to fall, I was going to get up. We were united. But when he started praying, he was on his own. If the Tibetan God was saying, let's go left, I was going right with my Jesus. There was total misalignment. And that changed how I lead, in a way, when I came back to my corporate job. And it's something that I talk about with leaders as well. And once again, the mountain was closed. Nepal lost about 9,000 people. Tea houses that we stayed in, which are like B&Bs, were on the ground when we were coming down the mountain. And I came home to more and more people saying, you can't do this. 2016, I couldn't go back because I couldn't afford it. And we sent out probably over 200 letters. No one was sponsoring us. In fact, we even asked, who's the man taking you? And, you know, what makes you think you can? So the world didn't believe this was something that was worth me following, at least someone like me. And so I decided 2016, I'll continue training. I was running, cycling, and unfortunately I fell off my mountain bike, landed in a coma for like 3 weeks, and thought the dream was done, until I ran the Soweto Marathon in November of that year, and I decided I was going to go back to Everest 2017. Went back to Everest 2017, the first time I ever had a real shot. Still with Nawang, my Sherpa from the past two attempts. On my third attempt, we go all the way up to the south summit, which is 99 meters from the top. The winds change like you cannot believe. I see Nawang is struggling, and I'm looking at him, I'm thinking, it's the first time I'm in the death zone. So me struggling, I understand. You struggling is a problem. What's going on? And he says to me, no, the weather is not what we predicted. It's bad. And I said to him, no problem, let's go back to camp 4, because I had bought additional oxygen, and we'll come back when the weather subsides, which happens. And we start going back, but unfortunately, my oxygen tank wasn't working, which I didn't realize, and he didn't either. Somehow, it was blocked, and for almost 5 to 6 hours, I was inhaling and exhaling the same air. And I'm saying to him, I'm not feeling stronger, because as you come down, you get more and more oxygen. So you should be feeling stronger, but I'm not. And he says, Sarah, look, there are the tents. Keep going. And I keep going and I lose consciousness. So some of this is hearsay. He couldn't help me because he was also not in a good space. He goes to the camp, gets other Sherpas. They come and carry me. We get to camp 4. Our tent has been blown off. So they say the winds were about 60 kilometers an hour, 60, 62 kilometers an hour on that time. And because we had left our tent in the middle of the night to go climb, it just blew off the mountain. So he took a makeshift tent that was there, put me in, but he changed my oxygen tank. And he went to sleep with the other Sherpas. Now, if you know anything about high altitude, if you think the person won't make it, that's the only time that you leave them in their own tent. But if you think they'll make it, you sit there, keep them warm, keep talking to them, making sure they are late. And he really didn't think I would make it. And the next day, I feel people pulling me. I wake up and I look at the guy. It's another Sherpa. They had come with a stretcher to come and you know, pick up the body, because when I said Lakpa, he looks at me, he says, Sarah, you're alive. And I'm thinking, of course I'm alive, but I'm hungry. I mean, I had not eaten since the previous day, almost 30 hours I hadn't eaten. He says he doesn't have any food. He had a bit of water. which is gold at that level. He gives me the water, and I said, I want to get onto the stretch. I stood up and looked at Everest, so close and yet so far. I think it's the first time that I too gave up on the dream. I wondered if all those people that said I couldn't, I didn't belong, were right. I think when the naysayer's voice become louder in your head, you are in trouble. So I came back home. I was in hospital. I had given up inside, but I didn't tell anybody. But I still trained, because at some point training becomes part of your life. And my son, he was 15 at the time. I remember him looking at me while I was in the lounge, whether I was reading or watching TV. I don't remember what I was doing. And he said to me, "Mom, when are you going back to Everest?" Not, "Are you going back?" It's, "When are you going back?" Because there is no way this mom who always tells me never give up has given up. So I probably looked bored, in all honest. And I said to him, 2020. And in 2019, 3 weeks before the Everest season opened, Lwazi Ngwenya, the young man that believed that I could, lost his life. And I remember just reflecting. I mean, death for me always reminds me of my own mortality, and reminds me that I don't have too much time. And that's why there's one thing I always say to people, being a VIP, being visible, intentional, and present in every moment, because the next moment is not necessarily guaranteed. And I was invited to go and speak at his memorial, and I thought the best thing would be to go and fulfill his dream. He believed I would be the first one. I am going to go to Everest. I printed out his picture. I took my stuff that I always have with me when I go to Everest, and I went to Everest in 2019. I went to Everest not necessarily as a plan that I had worked on for 6 months or 12 months, but because it was unfinished business, because I realized that, you know, only I need to be my own cheerleader, and that if he believed in me so much, every time I climbed with him when he was still alive, he would go on the summit, he would put his finger up to say number one. I wanted to do it not just for me, for him and all those people that have been told that they can't. I did a few things differently. I didn't take a Sherpa because they were just a Sherpa. I went with Noel Hanna, who had summited Everest 8 times, but was also a mountain guide, a registered international mountain guide at altitude. I also didn't go and try to climb like other people that I didn't train with. I asked Noah at every point to say, by when do we need to get to Camp 1? If he said 9 hours, I planned for 7, 8, and I stuck with my Sherpa, and I celebrated getting to Camp 1, getting to Camp 2, getting to Camp 3, knowing that at any time, anything can happen. I wasn't anxious about the summit, which I was in previous attempts. I just took it one step at a time. I bought my own weather report. I bought extra oxygen like I did previously, but my own weather report. If they said, get out of this tent, I looked, is it safe? I learned how to read the weather report, you know, and I got out. And when we got to Camp 4, we were 4 of us, Noah, Hannah, who was a leader, and 2 other Irish climbers, and I was the only South African. And we said we were going to get to the summit in 12 hours. If we were not there in 12 hours, it didn't matter how much money we had paid, we were going to come down. And so in 11 hours, 15 minutes, on the 16th of May, someone like me was able to step on top of the world. What a moment. I remember just being emotional, crying. Then you remember the tears are going to freeze. I'm going to get hurt. So you get out of it very quickly. And I looked at the horizon, but the first thing that came to my mind is my mother saying, the sky is the limit. And how wrong she was, because I was standing above the clouds. And that's why I always say, we have unlimited potential. Just because there are things that we have not seen in our community, in our country being done, doesn't mean that they are impossible. And like Mandela said, it always seems impossible until it's done. Everest has taught me many things about leadership, about myself. The first I'll start with, partnerships. As an overachiever getting up there and being humbled by the mountain, I was taught the biggest lesson that nobody gets to the top alone. But at the same time, not everyone can be your partner. So you have to be very deliberate about the people that you surround yourself with. Having said that, not everyone that partners with you up to Everest Base Camp is necessarily the right person to go with you further than Base Camp. We're always loyal to strategies, people, and environments that are no longer serving us. Sometimes you just need to let them go in order to move forward. It's being cutthroat about your own journey and your own greatness, because nobody else, everybody's busy with their own. About making decisions under pressure with incomplete information, but also knowing that the consequences can be irreversible, even deadly. It's taught me how to be obsessed with due diligence. When you get onto Everest, there's ropes that they put up. Every year they put new ropes. Most years, the previous year's ropes are there. So when you get up there, you need to know, is it a 2026 rope that I'm attaching myself to? Or am I in 2026 attaching myself to a 2020 rope? That is fatal. In business, you lose money. Your bottom line bleeds. But on the mountain, you lose your life. It's being unapologetic about strategies that I'm going to follow and being loyal to my own journey many times and the people that I surround myself with. Having said that, important also for me to be the right partner to the people that are with me. The other thing that Everest has taught me is to over-prepare, anticipate when things go right, and anticipate when things go wrong. But more importantly, when you get to the summit, know that the summit only ends when you get back to Everest Base Camp. Because 80% of the deaths on Everest and other big mountains happen when people are coming down. So in business, it's that you are ahead of your competitors. Don't be complacent. Celebrate, yes, but quickly pull yourself together and keep going. And don't take your eyes off the ball, because when you're coming down, your oxygen is a lot more reduced. Your competitors are also coming along, you know, and you are fatigued. Do you have enough oxygen and energy to get you to the bottom? So Everest has got many lessons, and I'm passionate about that mountain. I think I have a love-hate relationship, but it's given me such a gift as an individual, as a leader, as a mother, and as somebody in the community. I created When Shift Happens because I realized in my own journey that when shifts have happened in my life, that's when I've been called to grow. I'm obsessed about where I've grown and identifying that and even nurturing it than being obsessed about what's gone wrong that I cannot change. And I found that when I read and I talked to some of my friends and people in my circle, they've also changed their lives drastically because of shifts that have happened in their lives. But there's also another type of person that gets paralyzed because of the shift. And my aim is to go out there to leaders, and by leaders I mean a receptionist, an individual, because we are all leaders in our own right, whether it's in the office, at home, or in the community. Embrace the shift, because therein lies your growth, because you are becoming the great version of yourself because of the shift. So let's not frown upon them. If you think back about when we were young and we couldn't walk, we're crawling, you know, and when we walked, the world around us applauded. There she's walking, he's walking. And we walked a bit more until we didn't remember that we used to crawl. But when we are adults, when we fell, everybody say, oh my God, you've fallen. And I get so embarrassed. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to learn from it. I want to forget it. Or I want to cry about it forever. Let's not be victims to our fall. Let's be victors beyond the fall, because that's what we are called to. And one of the things that excites me the most, when I started, especially after getting to Everest and being made to feel like I didn't belong, I said, I'm just an ordinary African woman trying to reach extraordinary heights. Scrap that. I'm uniquely extraordinary. You are uniquely extraordinary. And being ordinary is a choice. And your extraordinariness demands that you go through a shift, mental shift, physical shift, and reality shift. Let go of what is not working and keep moving. So if you're listening to this podcast, it's all about shifts. If you're going through your own shifts, if you know somebody that's going through a shift, send them a little bit of this. They may learn something. And if they want to share with us their own shift, and maybe we can have them on the podcast, it's all about shifts are part of life. Embrace them. Grow into your greatness. And I pray that this podcast helps you realize that, reminds you of your greatness, and reminds you as well to embrace your own shift as you grow into your greatness. If you're listening, I hope you pick up something as you thrive beyond where you are today. Join the journey, the summit journey. Let's go together. Let's go from here and let's go higher. If you would like to explore some of the lessons and tools we spoke about today, you'll find them in the show notes. If today's conversation spoke to you, share it with someone that's facing their own climb. Together, we are rising, one shift at a time. When Shift Happens is a Jackpod original podcast by Jacaranda FM. Let's go higher.